until this morning they observing, witnessing the way it is. The state of mind you're in, the just to take an interest in being the observer, the witness, the knowing, the knowing. In emotional qualities, mental states that these are, of course, arise through conditions, you know, so the state of your health, can even the time of the month, the whether it's morning or evening, noon, full moon or no moon, springtime, whatever. The mood is, of any of us, is changeable according to the conditions that we're experiencing. So the putto, or the knowing of this, is transcending the mood. We can observe, you know, we can witness too the state of mind, the mood of conscious experience at this time as an object. And so this sense of recognizing this subject-object relationship of knowing from the putto position rather than from the sense of my feelings and my mood, the self view. And so the self view is always very much, you know, how we generally experience life is, I feel like this, and the identity with the particular mental state that we're experiencing, or just reacting to it. And there's so many patterns of resistance or rejection of mental states, or not looking, not observing, but merely bypassing it. Trying to do something, get something out of some idea of attainment or what should be done. So even this, you know, observing this, the feeling that there's something to do, something I've got to do, I've got to get or get rid of, that can be observed, that can be an object. In Pali, aramana is the word for that, the object. So then the most people don't differentiate subject and object. We all align it with the ego is very much based on claiming, on habit patterns, on identity, on attachment. So the only way out of that, to free ourselves from that, is through the awareness of it. So this listening or attentiveness, alertness, sati sampajanya, is the kind of essence, is the real heart of Buddhist teaching. A lot of mental states, as I've said before, are not clearly definable, and they can be vague, confused, just feeling of insecurity or lack. It can be relatively unnoticeable unless we pay attention. Not to, and again, I emphasize, it's not to define or label them, but to just trust in the awareness it's the way it is. So at this moment, there's the mood, and you can be aware of the body, your physical body. It's what does it feel like as experience here and now? Breath, the sound of silence, all these are present here and now. And this awareness then allows us to just notice them, witness to them. They are the way they are. So that you're no longer seeking to judge them or analyze them or claim them, but just recognition. And this awareness then is another way of reflecting is using metta practice, metta bhavana, which is loving kindness, or the loving kindness is acceptance of the way it is, or the object, whether it's another person or a situation or a mental state, whether it's you're inside you or outside. Metta is our ability to accept unconditionally the way it is. And so oftentimes metta is identified with external situations. Metta for other people, we say start with ourselves, metta for oneself, for may I abide in well-being, may all beings be happy, and so forth. This is the formula. But when you get to the very heart of metta practice, the beings then, whether they're near or far, or they're human or animal possible beings, or imagined beings, or mental states, moods of the mind, the body itself. Metta then is the skillful means of receiving and allowing anything to be what it is. It doesn't mean approving and liking everything. Trying to say we should love in the sense of liking every mental state we have or every human being we meet, but this unconditioned, it means accepting, allowing the present moment, whatever way you're experiencing it, to be what it is. So this is, we don't have to do anything about it. We don't have to, judge it or get rid of it or attach to it, but recognize. So having metta for oneself, may I abide in well-being, and then is a simple ability we have to witness to the beings that we're experiencing now. And you notice that the Buddha talks about sape sankharani cha, all conditions, all sankharas, and that includes your mental states, your physical body, your thoughts, opinions, views, the internal conditioned, subtle, coarse, and external, what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch. So metta as an ideal can be, you know, it's a beautiful ideal in itself, unconditioned love. And it's the kind of way we'd like to be, have this heart full of metta. But then, in terms of the realities of this present moment, the anger or resentment or doubt or whatever one is feeling, that's also a being also. And, you know, it is a condition, it's sankhara. The metta isn't particularly, you know, it ain't only human beings or sentient beings that have physical forms, but it includes all forms, whether, you know, all sankharas, mental, physical, emotional. And then with this practice of metta, it really, its essence is mindfulness. Because in the awareness, then we're not judging. It's not a judgmental factor in our experience. It's not saying how things should be or shouldn't be, but it's recognizing the way it is, because at this moment it can only be this way for each one of us, whatever, how you're feeling physically or mentally or whatever, good, bad, indifferent. You know, to want it to be other than that is making a problem about it. Even a bad mood, if one is in a very negative state at this moment, it's, you know, it's, as I say, you shouldn't feel like that. You know, this is making this a judgment, isn't it? The state of the bad mood you're in, you shouldn't have this mood, you should try to get rid of it, is coming from the ignorance of the mind. Because at this moment it could only be this way, you know, it is the way it is. And thinking of this, you know, how could it be otherwise? You know, how could you, you know, to make demands on the world to be other than it is at this moment is asking for the impossible. Because at this moment, what we're witnessing and observing is the way it is. This is an honest statement. There's alertness, attention. There's wisdom, metta, loving kindness. Or acceptance, taking the word metta out of the context of loving kindness, of just acceptance, unconditional acceptance. Then this way of training yourself to trust in this imminent ability we all have of paying attention to the present, being here and now. And, you know, that's the, as I said before, time is an illusion. There's only here and now. Experience is always now. So as metta as an ideal, then we try to do things to make ourselves fit the ideal, you know, try to, you know, live up to an ideal of unconditioned love or loving kindness. But it's coming from attachment to the ideal of metta. So what is the reality of metta right now? What is unconditioned love right now in terms of your witnessing, your conscious experience of this moment? And then you might feel very angry or upset with somebody or something, and well, I don't have any metta right now. I'm just too upset because those people, they shouldn't have done what they shouldn't have said what they said, and then we get caught into the attachment to the mood, or to be able to transcend the mood just through awareness of it. And this is also metta, isn't it? It's not transcending the mood to get rid of it. We think if we idealize transcending as a kind of weapon to get rid of what we don't like, then we've caught in delusion again. So this is where it's an unspoken, imminent awareness, pure subjectivity, Bhutto, the Buddha knowing the Dhamma. So in emotions like fear or panic or just anxiety, worry, in meditation, of course, these, when the conditions are there for these emotions to become conscious, then they are that way. They are what they are. And the reality of fear, then, is fear is a kind of primal emotion. It's, you know, we live in a realm of that's where fear is everywhere. This is a fear-ridden realm we're living in. Just like the animal world that we see around us, it lives in fear. You know, being survival of the fittest. So fear is a kind of, you know, it's not, it can be, we call it neurotic, or because we think we shouldn't have fear, we shouldn't be afraid as an ideal, but fear is part of, you know, the reality of this realm that we're living in, the conditioned realm, which is changing. Fear of death, fear of loss. Fear of the unknown. And as long as we're identified with the death-bound conditions, with the sankharas, then our life is very much influenced by that emotion, fear, because how could it be otherwise? Whatever we have, whatever we're attached to, whatever, no matter how secure we might feel in the present, we know it's going to change. Loss, fear of the future, fear of the Armageddon, fear of nuclear holocaust, fear of next earthquake, tsunami, a meteorite crashing into the earth. There's so many possibilities of misery and pain in this realm that we're, you know, that we're incarnated into. So many unknown factors in the universe itself is such a mystery. that potential of, you know, coming from outer space, aliens from outer space, or meteorites, or comets. Anything could happen. Terrorism, nuclear war, epidemics. There's always these rumors. You know, ever since I can remember, there's always been this kind of fear in the society that I've lived in. Because even though we would like to establish a society or where we don't have this fear, that we can really trust and count on and through our whole life, this is another ideal. But just recognizing, having a human body, a sensitive form, consciousness in a universe that is very vast, mysterious, with so many unknown factors influencing every moment of our conscious life. Now, is it the stars, the alignment of the planets, or the sun and the moon, or the forces out there? The Deva Loka, the Brahma Loka, the Asura Loka, the Preta Loka. I mean, these are all ways, words, concepts that we form around all the unknown, infinite possibilities of pleasure and pain that we can imagine within this. Contained within this physical body, this conscious moment. So you read, you know, so much of the literature of the previous century around the nature of existence and various religions' attempts to try to explain it and give a sense of security by, you know, putting your faith in some religious doctrine, some teaching. So that, like in Buddhist meditation, we're getting to the very source of this, where fear arises, in terms of our own direct experience of it, not on some kind of grand macrocosmic source, but this condition here that we call my body, myself, this is what we can actually learn from. So the unknown, isn't it, can be very frightening. The dark, the possibilities that we can imagine that we can't see directly, like ghosts, spirits, aliens from outer space, all these kind of symbols that they make films about, exciting horror films and whatnot about the unknown, the strange, the unexpected, the unseen, that can really cause us harm or misery of some sort or loss. Now that, of course, is, you know, the thinking process. What, you know, we create, we can imagine all kinds of possibilities, fantasy. We can fantasize, imagine all kinds of things happening. But to bring attention to the here and now, then, just this imminent attentiveness to the present, this is actually the path or the way out of that fear, the way not to get rid of fear, but to put fear in the perspective of a ramana, for what it is, And it is what it is. It's like this. And in that way of loving kindness and metta is receiving that the way it is, opening to it, not to let it, not the idea of if you open to it, it takes you over. There's always this fear of some evil force, some unknown alien force can take you over and make you into something, make you do things or become some demonic creature. But that fear, that kind of thing, is only possible through ignorance. As long as ignorance is the position we take on life, then of course we can. It's possible to become anything, become a demon or whatever, through ignorance, not through awareness. So the Buddha's encouragement to awaken, wake up, pay attention, observe the way it is. This is a wonderful, kind of marvelous and compassionate teaching to encourage us to do something that we actually can do, Not trying to become a Buddha or something else, but just within the limitation of the five khandhas that we experience, that awareness is the liberation itself. Now, metta then is, the non-judgmental way we can open and receive life. As long as there's conditions, I won't only accept things if I agree with it or like it or approve. And this comes from the ego, the fear-ridden ego, isn't it? Where I have to really control a situation. I have to, resist the evil forces or destroy them. I have to, my life is an endless battle. It's in this kind of dualistic level, what they call Manichaeism, the idea of this eternal battle between the good and the bad. And of course, that is that's the result of attachment to out of ignorance to the ideals of good and bad. The endless fighting, trying to control, destroy the axis of evil. Eliminate the pests, and the mind is very much conditioned to think in this way, this dualistic pattern. It's logical, isn't it? In order to sustain the good, you've got to get rid of the bad. If God is good, then anything that's not good, we should get rid of. It certainly makes sense, doesn't it? And on that level of of thought and concept. And so this thinking itself then is put in this perspective of an arumana. Thought is an arom, is an arumana. And to let go of thought, not to no longer to let thought be self, to create yourself endlessly with concepts and memories, but to be the awareness of thought. And then thought, of course, is dualistic. So, you know, when you think good, it immediately brings up bad. You know, because they're a pair, they go together, one extreme with the other. the shoulds and shouldn'ts, the prescriptions, you know, of what should be and what shouldn't be. So on that level of dualism of thought, then we, you know, we all know what should be and what shouldn't. We should love each other, we should have compassion, we should be kind, we should have fairness and justice, mercy. We should have peace, and the ideal of, you know, equality and freedom for everybody. We should treasure the earth and take care of it, be guardians to protect the environment, not just exploit it. We shouldn't be selfish. We shouldn't hate people, we should love them. And this is what thinking is all about, isn't it? Of should and shouldn't. You have the best and the worst. So at this moment, what is it that isn't a thought, that isn't, you know, you're not thinking, but just there's consciousness and there's attention. And so that I, you know, recognize through just this awareness. Recognizing this awareness is like this. So that the conscious experience is not attached to any particular thing. I'm not trying to be aware of anything in particular. You know, I've not got an agenda or some kind of thing I'm trying to pay attention to, but just learning to recognize a natural state of attentiveness, poised attention, openness, that it is metta. You know, because awareness then, not attached to anything, conscious, the conscious reality of this moment, then there's not attachment. So that what does become conscious is seen in terms of Dhamma. It's received in that way. And the nature of all conditions is arising and ceasing. So it's not a matter of me trying to get rid of bad thoughts because I shouldn't have them, but recognizing a bad mood or bad thoughts or bad memories are like this, by that our fear, anxiety and worry about the future is like this, then I'm allowing these beings, these conditions, to be what they are, and their nature, of course, is anicca, arising, ceasing. So trusting in that, you know, that insight is very powerful, so that there's nothing to do anymore. You know, it's not a matter of making yourself pure, trying to get rid of your faults and become a saint, but to just trust in this simple, immanent awareness in the present. So somebody was asking me about how to deal with fear the other day, and fear is a you know, very powerful emotional state that we experience, and a fear, of course, has tremendous power if, you know, by making us run away, isn't it? Because when we feel frightened, the immediate reaction is to run away or get rid of it. It's very, you know, very strong. In the early life as a monk, you know, I remember really confronting fear as I living at Tamsangpet, the first year at Tamsangpet in Amnath Chalern. I was living in this, they built, this was before the rainy season, so the villagers built a kind of platform in this cave. And then there were this, and it was, you know, raised above the ground, and there were, you know, there's a python living in the cave also. So then there were bats. And so I was in a place where, quite unprotected, living on this platform, didn't have any sides, didn't have a roof or anything, just a platform in this kind of grotto, rock grotto. And at night, and when there weren't any, there wasn't moonlight or anything, it was so pitch black. And you'd sit on this platform looking at the blackness all around. And then there'd be some animal moving, and there's an owl that makes some kind of weird noise, or, and you could imagine the python kind of winding its way up onto the platform and swallowing me. Or then ghosts, any possibility about ghosts, you know, how many spirits or unknown forces in that blackness. And just sitting there, looking out at that blackness, and it seemed so vast, you know, where did it end, you know, just, you know, when you're looking, you know, your eye, my eyes were open, looking at this black infinity in front of me. There was no, you know, couldn't see an end to it. It just seemed to go on and on, and any possibility, anything I could think of. And out of that blackness, the tendency wasn't to create, like, out there guardian angels and radiant beings protecting me in that blackness. The mind tended to move into the more negative states, like, you know, thinking about the spirits, the dark spirits, the demons, the ghosts, the possibility of all kinds of horrible, dark, dangerous, and menacing creatures that one can imagine in that dark surround. And little old me, you know, with sitting there on this platform, just waiting to be taken over or eaten by something, a wild animal or whatever. So then in the Tudunga tradition, you have these umbrellas you make, you know, with a mosquito net around them. So I'd just sit out on this dark platform and get scared just thinking about what's out there in the dark. And I'd go in the inside this mosquito net and light a candle, you know. So then the candle light would light up the area within the mosquito net, which wasn't very big at all, no bigger than that cushion I sit on. And yet I didn't feel so frightened after that, because I could see around me, you know. If there was any demonic forces, wild animals, or tigers waiting to eat me, or a python, that mosquito net would have not been any kind of protection whatsoever. You know, but the sense of seeing, you know, the candle light and the contained space. It wasn't this infinite blackness out there. It was contained, light contained within a circle that would make me feel much more secure. the mind wouldn't go into these wild fantasies, because I could actually see what was around me. The immediate space around me was, there weren't any, dangerous creatures there. So that's the, oftentimes what we how we live our lives, isn't it? In this delusion of you know, still the dangers are ever present, but we live in a way that we don't have to feel that so much. We have the illusion of safety. We have the candle flame in the mosquito net that gives this sense of, I know what's around me. It's okay, I'm all right. But when you look at the universe, you know, on a at nighttime, the stars and the, you know, it is, it's possibilities, the probabilities. You know, the planet we live on is such an unstable, uncertain thing, isn't it? And the tsunamis and earthquakes, things like that, catastrophes happen, and we're shocked. How could our solid Earth, you know, where can we go that we can really trust that we'll be safe? Because all these plates that shift, you know, we have no control over them. How we can control the this planet so that we'll feel safe in it all the time. But we like the illusion of safety. You know, create the illusion that everything's going to be all right. So then, because of the meditation, I could really observe this sphere. You know, start just, instead of just being caught up in the fantasies that I could create, the demonic fantasies and the possibilities for all kinds of horrible things happening in the dark, if I just was aware of this feeling, it's quite palpable fear, you know, it's not something very subtle. So one can actually observe it, open to it. And that openness is a metta practice, isn't it? Opening, allowing fear, the presence of fear, with loving kindness or acceptance. Now that's going against the whole reactive pattern of our human state, isn't it? Fear usually its power lies in deluding us. You know, I have power over you. If I can frighten you, make you afraid of me, then I've got a lot of power over you. So I come on really strong and fierce, and I make you frightened of me. I actually have power. You've given me the power to control you through fear. And that's how tyrannies work, isn't it? And is to, you know, like secret police organizations and Gestapos and things like that. You have to run a country, you know, if you're a tyrant, you have to make everybody frightened to control them, because you can really terrify, like Saddam Hussein in Iraq, certainly, you know, could sustain his tyranny through terror, through making everybody frightened of, you know, criticizing or doing anything against his wishes. So he had control, and the Iraqi people empowered him with that. Because we're all participating in this game, you know, it's not just one way. So if we don't understand fear, then we are, or we can easily be manipulated and controlled by others, by governments or dictators or partners or whatever. So then the recognizing this fear, the metta practice then is receiving. Fear is like this. You know, the when we spread metta and we share the merit of our practice, it's with all the forces in the universe, the Lord of death, the good, the bad, the high, the low. It's not just sharing the goodness of our life, the blessings of our life with only the good forces in the universe, but it's with the negative ones also. So this is like metta is non-critical, doesn't place conditions. You know, like conditioned love is, I love you if you obey me. If you live up to my principles and standards, behave yourself accordingly, conduct yourself in the way that I approve of, and then I love you. But the minute you don't, there's no love anymore. And that's another kind of, threat, isn't it? It's threatening everything. You know, you have to please me in order to receive my love, my approval. Well, that's conditioned, isn't it? That's not love in the sense of metta. That's, that's kilesa. So unconditioned love then, or metta, doesn't demand approval. It's not approving of anything. Or liking, doesn't imply liking, but allowing things to be what they are. So that, because our relationship to the conditioned realm is witnessing it, recognizing it, and no longer attaching to it, identifying, being lost in the power of the kilesas. When I was at Tamsang Pet, then I noticed that learning to just trust in this awareness in the dark. That even if I put the candle outside the mosquito net, sit outside the mosquito net with candlelight, I noticed that when a candlelight shines in the dark, in the vast space, then it makes even weirder kind of shadows, creepy kind of eeriness in this rock grotto. You sit out on the platform outside the mosquito net with the candle, and then the flickering candle, all kinds of shadows would move in eerie forms. I mean, imagination could easily create all kinds of weird possibilities of ghosts and demons through the eeriness of the light of the candle flame when it's not contained within the mosquito net. Then there was one owl that used to stare at me. Which is another, one could easily project onto that owl all kinds of evil intentions. Never did anything, never harmed me in the least. But when I, you're testing this out, when I open to this darkness, this eeriness, this fear, with loving kindness, and this way, I mean, it's like trusting in this awareness. Just this simple attentiveness to where the fear could be seen as an object. But not to get rid of it, not to get rid of the fear because I don't want it, but to just receive fear. Fear is this way. It is the way it is. And then you're actually you know, allowing things to be what they are, and they arise and cease according to their nature. That's the way all conditions are. They, some, you know, the movements, or some disappear immediately, and others take time, things like that. So not a matter of you know, short time or long time, or instant or gradual, but allowing, you know, whatever, it to be what it is, it to fulfill its karma, in other words, from beginning to end or birth to death. Then by trusting in that awareness, then the fear, you know, would drop away, because I'm not feeding it. So it always reminded me of, you know, these stories of dragons that, you know, they're really, you know, full of air. They're nothing much, but they have the appearance of being ferocious and dangerous. And then as you turn around them and receive them with loving kindness, they shrivel up. There's nothing in them, but they have a power to chase you your whole life if you just keep running. And so suddenly the dragon comes and goes, boo, and you run away. Then it's that empty thing called a dragon can keep chasing you for your whole life, and you'll keep running until you stop running. And you're not killing the dragon, you're not trying to stab it, but just disempower it. No longer, you know, empowering it with your fear. But by recognizing it, receiving it with loving kindness, then its nature is it no longer has the ability to frighten you, so it shrivels up, disappears. And it's not trying to kill it either, isn't it? It's not malevolent, trying to kill off the dragon, but to receive it with loving kindness. So this awareness, metta practice, they align themselves really in this perfect way. Dealing with conditioned phenomena, isn't it? Metta has no critical function. So that's why metta is for the angels, the devils, the lord of death, the good, bad, everything. All possibilities, all variations, permutations on conditioned phenomena, coarse, subtle, refined, gross, good, bad, indifferent, wonderful, horrible, all conditioned phenomena, then is accepted for what it is, and then it fulfills its role, it lives its span. And so in this way, when we develop this metta practice, awareness, align the awareness. Not so we don't idealize metta into some kind of high emotional state of feeling good about everything, but bringing it down to much more practical reality, where we can actually use in the midst of when we are frightened, when we are being abused or treated badly by others, or life is not being fair to us, and you know we've got every reason on personal level to be angry and upset and frightened, but then the awareness is the gate to liberate ourselves from being caught and bound into that limitation. And it's not an annihilation of the conditions, is it? It's receiving condition phenomena in terms of the Buddha and Dhamma, the wise reflection on the way it is. So this word Dhamma is recognize it's the conditions are Dhamma and the unconditioned. The created and the uncreated. So in the uncreated then, one can't create the uncreated. I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it? So if you know, if you create an idea about the uncreated, then you're attached to another idea. There's something called the uncreated, and I believe in the uncreated, or I mean, the Buddha said, talked about the deathless and the uncreated. Don't know what that is, but I believe in it. There's not, you know, that's still the created, isn't it? You're still operating from the created. So reflect, you know, what at this moment isn't created? In terms of your experience here and now, and so this awareness then, sati sampajanya, you know, I'm not creating it. Well, I can create a kind of tranquil mental, emotional state by closing my eyes and concentrating on a refined subject, a refined object to absorb into. I can create a refined conscious experience through controlling the conditions that I'm experiencing at this time. But then as, you know, as soon as the eyes open or things change, then the tranquil state is gone. You know, so it's very dependent on control, you know, to live a refined life, a life just with beauty and all the best, it means you have to exert a lot of control to sustain that for very long. And you have to, you know, live in it pretty much by avoiding and not looking, not noticing a lot most of what's around you. To live in the mosquito net with the candlelight. You know, the contained space where you can see everything and everything's fine because everything you see is okay and no threat. But out there, once you get out there, outside the mosquito net, who knows what's lying in wait, what possibilities of loss and pain and misery might be. So it's better to live in this controlled state that you can, you know, you have got control over it, and you've got, you know, you can just stay in the mosquito net with the candle burning and feel safe. Or go outside the mosquito net and look at the fear, the unknown, the blackness everywhere, the infinite, seemingly infinite blackness goes on and on. And also recognizing that the insight also, you know, just through visual consciousness, looking at blackness, you know, then the emotions react, what's out there? What could be out there? I heard a strange noise, and then that strange sound over there, and that weird-looking owl up there in the trees looking at, what does it want? You know, is it a spirit of some sort? And what if that python comes? You know, pythons and they're big snakes, they could kill me. And there's rumors that there's a tiger and who knows what, kind of all kinds of insects and scorpions and than ghosts. Rumors about somebody being murdered at Tum Sang Pet. There's probably a ghost here, some evil demon. There's always rumors of some horrible thing happening. Or going outside the mosquito net and looking at the fear and at the blackness. And what is it that can see the blackness? You know, what is consciousness but light itself, isn't it? That which sees the darkness is a, through the eyes, sitting out on the platform, Tum Sang Pet, no moon, no light, just blackness. And yet, I'm looking at blackness. And that very, bringing that attention to consciousness. You know, that's the light of consciousness that can see the blackness. So in this way, the you know, you're resting in this awareness. The light of awareness, rather than in the objects that you're that you might create in your mind or experience through your senses, just reacting to them, to their beauty or frightening possibilities. So this is like what I'm doing is a reflection, isn't it? It's sitting in the mosquito net, and this kind of false security. Everything's all right, you know. I don't feel frightened when I'm in this. And then if I think, well, what's outside there? And then I start projecting outside the mosquito net, I could become frightened again. Because outside the mosquito net is, you know, is vast. The mosquito net isn't very big. Candle flame isn't very much light. So then the awareness, that's not dark. It's like switching on the light, isn't it, being attentive and alert, even when even in the middle of night. Being attentive and alert in the middle of fear, anxiety, worry, when the world around you is falling apart, when all your friends leave you and desert you, when you're put into a dungeon, chained to the wall, whatever. There's still this escape from suffering through awareness. So it's like exploring experience, you know, this in Vipassana meditation is really an investigation. Yoniso Manasikara. In Pali, they've got all these words that convey this sense of looking into, inside. Vipassana itself means looking into the nature, looking deeply into it, not just you know, labeling things and then not going any further than the surface or the kind of superficial labels that we project onto experiences. So you can see it's not an intellectual endeavor just to name everything in sight and use logic and reason, but it's from a this level of intelligence where punya operates, wisdom, developing the wisdom faculty to see things the way they are, to know in the know for yourself. Bhajjitang vai thidapo inuhi, to know through your own insight, not through what somebody else tells you. Or not knowing about something through reading or just operating from views and judgments that we acquire from outside. So in the, you know, during this retreat, you know, what really challenges you during this time? You know, maybe, you know, it can be fear or doubt, or but see it always. This is something to really learn from. Disillusionment, despair, doubt. These are part of, these are developing the path. Everything is the path. You know, people give up the path because they become disillusioned or despairing or doubtful about themselves or about the tradition or whatever. But these are always opportunities. Or people fall in love with somebody else, and then that's the reason for leaving, because that's another opportunity to see the, you know, to get beyond the conditioned phenomena that one is easily dazzled by or reacting to. So it really takes like determination this is a strong determination, because we've all challenged a lot, you know, in all kinds of ways, because of our karma, you know, different things arising, different things changing, disappointment in monastic life. You don't know how much I've been disappointed personally. You know, when you see your fellow monks and nuns give up and disrobe and things like this, you feel incredibly disappointed. But that's also part of the path, isn't it? Not to get lost in disappointment, or to, you know, to when the people that you feel this monastic bond with decide they want to go somewhere else, get out of it, or do something else. But that's also, you know, the path. This is, everything is part of, it belongs, you know, everything belongs. So whatever you're experiencing, you know, of faith and inspiration and motivation and so forth, the good side, or the desperation, the disillusionment, the doubt, despair, it's, you know, this is all conditioned phenomena. Falling in love is conditioned phenomena. You know, it's not to dismiss it as put it down, but it is, you know, falling in love is not ultimate reality. And it changes, you know, you fall in, then you fall out. So this is, just recognizing this, the in terms of Dhamma, then it becomes Dhamma. What What begins ends. What comes together separates. So the refuge then is not in trying to create a monastery where all the monks and nuns are determined, dedicated, really ideal monks and nuns, you know, that with strong determination have all the best qualities to have the perfect monastery. I've given up on that one. But to use the monastery you're in for awareness. So, you know, this is, you know, Amaravati is like this. You know, so not saying it's the best or it's the way all monasteries should be, or just to spend time picking it apart and thinking, well, it could be better or should be or shouldn't be, but to use the opportunity here, the encouragement is not to you know, we're not forming a cult of devotees with a party line, but trying to give opportunity and occasion to really reflect and observe, develop, the cultivate the bhavana, this eightfold path, this way of liberation. And to do this, you don't need to have, you know, the perfect place with the perfect teacher and the perfect sangha and the perfect this, because there isn't any. And I've never found one perfect Buddhist monastery. Even Wat Pa Pong Rajan Chah, well, I could find plenty of faults with that monastery. And wherever, I mean, I'm quite a critical person, so I'm very good at finding fault with me, with you, with every place. So the perfection isn't the point, isn't it? It's the willingness to use the situation with attention, awareness, cultivating, this word bhavana. So even at times of great despair, you know, feelings of failure and despair, you learn a lot from that. You know, these are very valuable. And I look back in my monastic past of the amount of despair and disappointment, and yet that's also because the willingness to use that to learn from despair, from disillusionment, from disappointment, means that, you know, I'm willing to allow this emotion to be what it is. And it is, you know, it's certainly not permanent, I guarantee it. I don't feel despair anymore. So it's, but it's not because I'm suppressing, you know, I'm living in my mosquito net with my candle flame and just trying to be, everything's all right, isn't it? All around me, everything's okay. And then, please tell me everything is okay. I used to be like that. Just tell me everything is okay. Don't tell me the truth. Because I like the delusions. With Ajahn Chah, when he was really very, very sick, and he'd go into it, they had a special kuti to take care of him. And you'd go there and you'd see Ajahn Chah lying there helpless and and be rather depressing. And then I'd go over to his old kuti in the main part of the monastery, and there was this wax effigy of Lungpa Cha sitting on the seat, you know, with his holding his stick like this. They look, and they make these effigies very lifelike. You know, they look like Lumpur Cha sitting there. And I remember sitting at the feet, bowing to this effigy of Lumpur Cha, this plastic model, and thinking to myself, I think I prefer this plastic model. It makes me feel better to sit in front of the plastic model and then to go back into the cootie and see the reality. And so how many human beings live with the plastic models of life and the illusions? Or just tell me everything is okay. Is everything okay? Yes, Ajahn Sumedho, everything's okay. You're sure now? Yes, everything's fine. You're sure? Yeah, everything's okay. No problem. I feel okay. I feel okay if everything's okay. Even if it's not okay, tell me it's okay, then I'm okay. Or when life does get difficult, you know, and it's not okay and everything's falling, what's that like? What's it like when you lose, when you've lost, when the people you depended on and became bonded with leave, and there's disappointment, there's blame, people and spread rumors, and there's all kinds of criticisms and blame, and you think, oh, the whole thing's falling apart, I'm a failure. And then the awareness of that, of failure, of despair, of loss, is this way. That's opening with metta to this mental state. You know, that's very strengthening, because if you can endure through that, you can endure through anything. Because it can be very, you know, one could easily, you know, if one didn't have a way out, one could really get depressed. You know, when you get sunk into depression, it's hard to get out of it if you're totally committed to that reality. But if you trust the awareness, then you find increasing confidence and strength in the path, the Eightfold Path.